Our next presenter this morning, I actually believe and is arguably the best medical malpractice insurance company in the history of the industry. And our chief presenter here today, I would say, is clearly the pioneer of the medical malpractice insurance business, Dr. Crowe. He's been in the business forever, founded the company back in 1976, and the track record is something to be envied. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Crowe and Ed Rand. Oh, Ed's going to do it. All right, Ed, the CFO, to start the presentation.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to just take us through some of the financial results for 2006 and then a bit of a retrospective over the last 5 years for ProAssurance, and then we'll turn it over to Dr. Crowe to get to the interesting stuff. Just a real a quick overview. We're market cap at $1.7 billion. In 2006, we crossed the billion-dollar mark in our equity. We are the fourth largest writer of medical liability insurance. We're the largest publicly traded specialist in medical liability. Insure over 40,000 policyholders. Majority of those are physicians and dentists. We're in 26 states, basically the eastern half of the United States, and highly rated by a variety of rating agencies. Starting with our balance sheet, we saw a significant growth in our balance sheet in 2006. Book value per share was up about 37% year over year. And there are really a couple drivers for that. In January of 2006, we sold our personal lines operations. We owned a personal lines company, wrote automobile business for teachers in Michigan. We sold that in January. In August of 2006, we acquired Pick Wisconsin, another medical liability writer focused in the Wisconsin and surrounding states. That also added to the size of the company, and then just organic growth. We had a very successful year, as we'll see in a second. Just to take a quick look at a couple items on our balance sheet, first starting with the investment portfolio. It is a fairly boring, conservative investment portfolio. We take a lot of risk on the liability side of our balance sheet, tend to take less risk on the asset side. So we've got an investment portfolio that is largely highly rated fixed income securities. Although we do look to allocate a portion of our portfolio to areas where we can find non-correlating returns and excess returns. So, for instance, we've got a TIPS portfolio. We've got a high-yield asset-backed portfolio. We invest in a number of limited partnerships. We've got a BOLI portfolio. So a variety of things there to try to add some excess returns, but all in all, a very conservative portfolio. Our capital structure is much the same way, a pretty conservative capital structure. We've got a debt-to-cap ratio of just under 14%, so a level of debt that we're very comfortable with, a level of debt that the rating agencies are very comfortable with, and a level of debt that allows us to maximize return to our common equity shareholders, which makes up the equity makes up about 86%. The debt's in really two pieces. We've got a convertible debt out there that the conversion option's triggered by the performance of our stock the 30 days following or preceding the end of any given quarter. And currently, that convertible debt is convertible. We've not had any activity on the conversion, but it is convertible, and it's callable in July of 2008. 6% of our debt is made up of trust preferred and surplus notes, some issued by ProAssurance, some acquired in some of the acquisitions that we've done. Those have call options, first one beginning in December of 2007, the remainder in the early part of 2009. Taking a quick look at the income statement, you can see the gross written premium line did not have the kind of growth on it that our balance sheet had. We are in a soft market right now in medical liability, as most of the industry is, and so growth is challenging. But the fact that we did show some premium growth is really counter to the prevailing trend in our sector, and we're able to show that growth through the acquisitions that we've done. In 2005, we acquired a company called Nicrick that was headquartered in Washington, D.C., wrote in D.C. and the surrounding markets, and then, as I mentioned earlier, in 2006, we acquired the Pick Wisconsin companies. That allows us to continue to show growth in the face of the prevailing trend, and it really, for us, is a preferred way to grow, and I think Dr. Crowe will touch on that slightly when he gets to his comments. Another thing that drove our success in net income for the year, we talked a little bit about investments. Another component of that is the combined ratio, and we saw an improvement in the combined ratio 2005 to 2006. And if you break it into its components, the expense ratio actually went up in 2006, and there are really two things driving that. One, we began expensing stock options and other stock compensation in 2006 in accordance with FAS 123R. And for ProAssurance, the way we report that expense ratio, we take all holding company expenses, all expenses for the organization, and put them into the expenses that are calculated for the expense ratio. So that shows up. In addition to that, we were hit twice with guarantee fund assessments from the state of Florida. They did two back-to-back assessments during the year where they went after the casualty companies, assessed 2% of written premium in Florida. That cost us about $2.3 million for the year. That is recoupable, and we will have the ability to recoup that in a premium charge over the next 2 years. But nonetheless, it hits the expense ratio in the current year. Loss ratio did see improvement year over year, coming from two areas. We did have a modest amount of favorable development during the year, about $36 million of favorable development on about $3.5 billion of reserves. In addition to that, we saw an improvement in the accident year loss ratio that we booked for 2006. The good, strong operations of our core operations has led to significant cash flow for the organization. And since the formation of ProAssurance, and ProAssurance was formed in 2001, since that time, we've generated $1.3 billion in operating cash flow. And that has obviously helped to fuel higher investment returns. And those investment returns, for every dollar of premium we earn, we now get 27 cents in investment income. That, coupled with just the strong operations that we've been showing, have led to an improving ROE. We target a 12 to 14% return on the business that we write. And over time, that should return a 12 to 14% ROE for our shareholders. Right now, we are in a period of being somewhat overcapitalized, which makes that return a little more difficult. But nonetheless, we were able to achieve that goal during 2006 with an ROE of 13.5%. was not a particularly stellar year for the stock return of our company. Anybody that's a shareholder knows that. However, we tend to look at things over the long term. And if you go back and look at the formation of Medical Assurance in 1991, which is the predecessor company to ProAssurance, we've had a book value growth, which is a key metric for us, of 16% on an annual basis, and a return to our shareholders of 18%. Looking at that on a shorter time frame, looking at it since the formation of ProAssurance, we've had comparable returns, book value growth again of 16%, return to our shareholders of 21% over that period of time. And all in all, we've created over $1 billion of shareholder value since the formation of ProAssurance in 2001. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Frank O'Neill to talk a little bit about the insurance cycle for medical liability.
Thank you, Ned. I'm going to see if I can stand out in front here just a little bit so I can show you this chart that I'm working on. I'm going to have to use a laser pointer. I'd love to be able to go over there and point, but I can't really do that. There is always a cycle, and what you've seen is an example of our performance across the cycles, but I want to emphasize to you just how the cycle has trended since AM Best began tracking data. Now, this is industry data since 1976. This black line that draws across here is the amount of premium collected by the industry in each year. No more revenue than that comes into any company. The blue line that just drew on is where the industry, in its infinite wisdom, put initial reserves. This is where the industry thought losses would develop. Now, just to show you how stupid our industry is, the red line that draws on here shows you where losses actually developed. The only time that losses and expected losses have been congruent was in about 1976, 77, and 78. The green area here at the left is where the industry has made money. Then the industry loses money. There's a big slug. Capital has come into the market, and we managed to fritter it away right here in this little section here, and then the industry starts to lose money again. Now, this is as if you were at December 31st, of 2000, knowing everything back perfectly to 1976. And if you'll notice from about here back, that's historical data, and it's not about to change. But look at this little red area here. Watch what happens when we now advance it forward to say we're at December 31st, 2001. Green area goes down a little bit. I'll run it backwards. Look at it. See, the green area goes down a little bit, and the red area starts to grow. And especially right out here in 2001, it starts to shoot upwards. Now we're at 2002. Losses have gotten far worse than we thought they would be, and premiums and losses and expected losses begin to trend up. Now we're out here at about 2003, but watch this red area as we go forward. Starting to see a little bit of optimism here, but here's where we think some of the new seeds of opportunity are being sown for us right now. The industry is pegging, again, developed losses, where they think losses will be, right on the line of where the initial reserves are here, and developed losses just above it. So the industry is seeking some optimism here. Those companies that feel like they need to have a reason for optimism can find it there. Conservative companies like ProAssurance are reserving a little bit more conservatively. Here we are in the next year. Here again, look at the initial reserve and developed losses right along the same lines. Now, history tells us that this is overly optimistic. There's only been one period over here at the left where we have been really accurate. That's why we prefer to be much more conservative. This is the new data. Most of you have seen some of this. I'm going to show you 2005, which is fairly new for us to present, but I want you to watch in here the actual losses, developed losses, over the past 5 or 6 years gets bigger as we go forward. There's still some pain to come through in this industry, but yet look that everybody here is still pegging initial reserves and developed losses right about the same area. It's all an estimate when it's this fresh. Our position is we want to estimate more conservatively. That's the industry cycle. Dr. Crow is going to tell you how we profit and thrive throughout the entire period of the cycle.
Anybody want to bet this point moves or doesn't move? We shall see. Actually, we're scavengers, and we think that the feeding has been set right there for 2010. Medical liability market in 2007, I'm not going to be behind the podium. I don't speak well from back there. Frequency and severity appear to be moderating. Optimism abounds in the boardrooms. Overall pricing is softening and dropping and sinking. Terms and conditions are holding. That's basically where we are. What are we doing at ProAssurance? We're pricing based on our targeted returns, and we're not pricing to take care of the top line. One thing that we said in the beginning a few years ago when we were in this tight market, we were having our internal conferences and planning, and we have told you guys that are interested in our company that we're not going to chase prices down when the market changes. Well, the market has changed from 3 years ago, and we have not chased the profits, the top line growth down, or even the top line at all. But what we do try to do at ProAssurance is continue to do what we've been doing for the past 29 years and what we've been doing since we've been public in 1991, and that is, number one, the first thing that we do is we protect our balance sheet. And everybody says, well, why are you so worried about that? And the answer is I own about 8% of the company. Any questions? First thing is you protect the damn balance sheet. I don't want to go broke. We defend non-meritorious claims, and the reason for that is I'm a physician. We started the company in 29, and being dumb, I didn't realize that we couldn't defend claims. And so we started the defending claims, and lo and behold, we won some of them. Really surprised some of the defense lawyers. And we built our reputation on defending claims. We defended something like 725 last year, up from about 450 the year before. But we do defend claims. As a result, we spend a lot of money on legal expenses, or ALAE. Number two, three, wherever I am in this presentation, there is a correlation between underwriting and losses. And guess what? There's a reverse correlation between losses and underwriting. And if you don't get those two departments to talking, nobody learns anything. And one of the things I've been dead set on since I've been in this industry is the two departments have got to communicate with each other to get rid of bad risk and to help us from assuming bad risk. I'm surprised the number of insurance companies that don't understand that. Several years ago, a guy in New York tried to tell me that we were no longer in the insurance business. We were an investment company because we had so much money to invest. We were a mutual fund. Well, we may have a lot of money to invest, but we're not any good at investing money, but we're really good at handling medical malpractice. We believe in risk management. We think what comes out of that claims department helps underwriting and it helps risk management, and risk management helps claims. We continue our connection with the doctors. We started by doctors 30 years ago. We still maintain our doctor relationships, working with committees in various states, and we now have about 15 of those committees working. Loss trends, talk about that for a minute. Everybody is optimistic because frequency is going down. And yes, frequency is down. Now, the question is this. Is frequency down because we had so much tort reform in various states that there was a bulge of claims to get them in ahead of the tort reform and then a natural drop after the tort reform becomes effective? Or is it down for some other reason? I.e., are the plaintiff lawyers getting smarter? Instead of filing 20 lawsuits, they carefully go through there and pick out the 5 or 10 best ones. And they're not filing that frivolous litigation anymore that they used to file because it cost them $50,000, $100,000 to carry this thing through trial. So we think that they're becoming much more discriminating in the type of suits they file. Now, if that's the case, does that mean our severity is going to go up eventually as they learn how to work these good cases that they're filing? We're not sure, but we do know that frequency is down, but we're not certain at this point that it's down permanently. Part of it is due to tort reform. Is the tort reform going to hold up? How about all these people that are dropping rates because we've got tort reform and we haven't had the constitutionality of them checked yet by the local Supreme Courts? Wisconsin lost the cap this past year on a cap that they'd had in effect for something like 10 years. Rates had dropped because of it. And then the Supreme Court comes in and wipes it out and says, no, that's unconstitutional. The real problem that we got is shock losses. The frequency is down. The working layer, which we consider up to $1 million, is pretty well under control. We can handle that. The problem that we got is those losses above $1 million that are up in the $5, $10, $20 million, in some cases $200 million range. We don't have enough of those to be able to sit down and actuarially calculate where that's going. And do we have enough reserves for all of those? We think so, but do we know so? No. The only thing we know is that our reserves are wrong. That's the only thing we know. This varies by state as to the severity of the problem. It also varies within a state. For instance, Ohio is an excellent state to write malpractice insurance business. Guess what? Cleveland's terrible. Missouri's pretty good. St. Louis is awful. Illinois is wonderful. Cook County, Chicago is terrible. Miami is terrible. Florida in general is terrible. Miami is worse. It just varies state by state, and for those of you that are locally exposed to a given state, it creates a problem. That creates a real good situation for a company that only does business in a good state, for instance, Tennessee. Got a mutual company up there. It probably should do pretty well. But it varies according to geographical distribution, et cetera. But fortunately, we can spread the risk. What are we doing? How are we responding? We continue to operate on shareholder value. We continue to look at what is our book value. We continue to look at what our return on equity. And I'll tell you, we do have an objective of 12 to 14% return on equity. And truthfully, we ought to hit 15% or so in good years. We did increase our book value a good bit this year, but that was because we sold MIMIC, which is our automobile business out of Michigan. And the question is, it was producing about a third of our profits, so why did we sell it? Number one, we thought that we would continue to show a good profit in the Med-Mal line, even if we got rid of it. There wouldn't be a tremendous decrease, if any decrease, in our profitability. Secondly, it was a very small company, $200 million, $225 million in revenue. As I looked into the future and I looked at the giants, Progressive and Geico, I didn't see how we could possibly compete with those people. A company came along and wanted to pay us 2x book for that business, and they wanted it a little bit more than we did, so we sold it. I will have to tell you that there was a lot of discussion internally there was a lot of opinions expressed, and some decisions were made that were not unanimous. But nevertheless, we made the decision. We did sell it. I am happy to report we sold it for $400 million. We paid $250 million for the whole thing about 5 years before that, including the Med-Mal business that we bought. We want to continue maintaining our market position, leading market position, protect the balance sheet, and we are building strength for the next turn. I saw so many people inadequately capitalized in this last hard market that we had, and they actually had to turn away business. For instance, we had to convert our occurrence business to claims made just because we didn't have the capital to continue to service it. The other good thing is because of our size, our balance sheet, and the currency that we have in our stock, we basically get to look at everything in the M&A sector. We get to look at books of business. We pretty well know who's headed for trouble before you guys do. We also have to look at, is somebody in trouble and available in a market that we want to be in? And believe you me, there are a few that are headed for problems that we don't want to be in the market that they're in, and we just totally stay away from them. This is where we're located. You can see with the dominant company states that we're in, the green ones, the top market share of 5%, the top five is in the blue states. But you can see we have this in Las Vegas and Nevada that was brought with the last acquisition. But in general, we don't go west of Texas. And the reason for that is it takes a long time to fly there. There you go. We believe that experience is the best teacher. I've been in the business 30 years. I don't know how much longer I'll be in it, but we've been through some cycles. And we have made some mistakes, and we probably make it one right now. But what we do try to look at is what is the cycle, what's the pricing, don't chase the top line. Keep your margins, keep your profitability up. Unfortunately, we've got some new managers in the game, and they've not been through any cycles, and they're going to go through some cycles, and they will learn, and everything will be fine. Our guys have been with our company on an average of 16 years, either with us or the predecessor that we bought. The average in the industry, the insurance industry, with our executive leadership is 21 years. We're owners. Our guys own 10% of the company. I own a good piece of the company. And if anybody in this room thinks that management thinks differently if they own a big percentage of the company, you're absolutely right. And if you want to look at management that owns one half of 1%, they don't much give a damn what the expenses do or how people spend money. What we intend to do is we intend to have disciplined pricing. We have tripled the size of our actuarial department. We look at each piece of business that we have on an annual basis and on those states where we have big pieces of business that is moving rather rapidly. And a good example would be Michigan, Ohio, et cetera. We look at those twice a year to make sure that we are properly priced. We are maintaining our margins at all costs. We continue to buy companies. We keep those key people that can give us information about claims management, marketing, underwriting, et cetera. We leave them in place. We operate on a regional basis, but we move all the other stuff that I'm not much interested in, like accounting and reinsurance and all of those kind of things. We move that to world headquarters down in Birmingham. This shows you that we differentiate ourselves from the very beginning, as I said, by defending cases. And this shows you what we've defended over the last 5 years, and we've reached a new pinnacle. I won't call it success, but I'll call it business. In last year, 725 cases. The plaintiff lawyers absolutely adore us. One of my rules of thumb is success is how often they complain against us. And believe it or not, we had a hearing in Indianapolis, in Indiana, this past year, just a few months ago, because a couple of the plaintiff lawyers complained about us. And the complaint was that we were not settling enough cases. And we go to the meeting, we say, damn right, that's us, guilty. What does that do for us? This compares ProAssurance to the industry data for 2004, and we've got 2006 for us. But we have what we call a favorable outcome of better than about 10 points over the industry in dropped and dismissed cases. We've got several points. It looks like about 13% over the defense verdicts. But look down here in the settlement area where we only run 8%. The industry runs 22%. But the downside to that is what we do at trials and how many of them we lose. We lose a lot more than the industry does. Now, yeah, that's the one I want. This shows last year ProAssurance versus this year. notice there's not a great deal of change, but a little bit, but it mostly has to do here in this segment versus the 18.5% settlement. And I think this is the reason we had so many trials last year. But here's the proof of the pudding. If you look at us over the last 5 years and how we spend our money and what our ratios are, the red is what we pay out in indemnity payments. And this just happens to be us in 2005, which was very low. And I don't believe we have six here, but this is the five-year average, which is what you really want to look at in any way in the Med-Mal sector. But look what we pay lawyers. We pay a hell of a lot more to lawyers than the competitor does. And I've often told defense lawyers, I'd rather see you rich than the plaintiff lawyers rich. Unfortunately, with tort reform, frequency is dropping. Guess who bitches the most? Plaintiff lawyers? Nope. Defense lawyers. Defense lawyers complain, business is down, we had to let some people go, the firm is shrinking. And I say, God, isn't it wonderful? Lawyers are out of work. Everything is beautiful. Next slide. This is where we are, and you've seen this just a few minutes ago, but it looks at our annualized stock return, 18% since we went public in 91, and, of course, our book value, which had a nice bounce this year due to multiple reasons. But basically, we have a successful track record of market leadership. Our plan for the future, to continue to operate from our regional platform approach, defending cases. We're going to look for growth mostly through M&A activity right now, be it books of business, et cetera. We are trying to do some organic, get some organic growth, but truthfully, we're not going to sell a whole lot of new business because we're not going to price it down if we're people who come with us. But we do have a focused and interested and invested management team to carry us forward. And so, with that, I'm going to open the floor. Is that correct?
Yep.
To questions. If I'm dumb, I got some answers. This gentleman had his.
If you could repeat the question, Dr. Kirk.
I'm sorry?
Repeat the question for the webcast.
Repeat the question?
Yes.
For the webcast, for the webcast. People listening in.
Okay.
My question is on claiming behavior, the behavior of claiming. Observation is, you know, direct to consumer marketing and, you know, really began with the pharmaceutical industry 10 years ago. Seems to me it's taken off by the, you know, advertising for hospitals, for physician groups. And I'm wondering if the confluence of that and just through the internet, people generally being smarter about, at least more knowledgeable when they go to their physician, not down, about health care, about the treatment options, does that change the dynamic between the medical provider and their client, the individual seeking medical care, and had any spillover effect on insurance?
You think I can repeat this? He's asking, is the behavior in the, on the part of the general public because of the change in relationship between patients and physicians due to internet marketing, TV, what do they call that, pull marketing, where they advertise their pills and you ask your doctor for it. The answer is that there's a lot more of that going on. I'm seeing some data now that 20-25% of the prescriptions being written are suggested by the patient. How about that? I think the more of that we do, that sooner or later we're going to see greater expectations from the public on outcome, and that may influence an upward trend in frequency. Now, don't hold me to that. That's my guess. That lady had hers up. Is that who I think it is?
Yeah. I don't know who you think it is.
She didn't give me a hug today. Go ahead.
I'm
taking
for later.
Come on. You know my answer. Go ahead. The question is, are we going to change in Florida because of the tougher environment? And she's specifically referring to the $200,000 verdict we got against one of our insureds in Florida.
If you want to answer to that, yes.
No, I don't want to answer to that. The question is that Florida is a little bit tougher legally than probably some of the others, but they're not any tougher than Cook County and Philadelphia and St. Louis and Cleveland, that kind of thing. I think the problem down in Florida, we start with the fact there's some really good, smart plaintiff lawyers down here. That's one thing. Secondly, for some reason, the juries have a tendency to sometimes bring back wild verdicts. But in general, they bring back good verdicts. We still receive a normal amount of defense verdicts down here. The problem is we no longer see a $600,000 verdict in Florida. You see a $6 million verdict in Florida, a $20 million verdict in Florida. The only thing that you can do is you appeal those, you fight them, you do the best you can. I will have to say that we are really not aggressive in Florida right now in our marketing. We think there's going to be a blow-up in Florida. At least I do. These guys don't agree with me. But this attitude that Florida is setting up all of these state-guaranteed funds, well, you know and I know that they're not going to run them correctly. They're going to run them with a deficit. And sooner or later, there'll have to be a call for money from somewhere. It will either come from the general fund or it will come from the taxpayers. That ain't going to happen. So where's the money going to come from? It's going to come from the insurance industry when they explode this thing and they don't charge enough premium. So we think that there's a high risk of doing business in Florida that you're going to later be assessed for these funds. And we're not overly eager to extend our presence in Florida. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you, Beth. Question. Cities.
Cities are not so good. Is that because the doctors are different than cities
are
looking for lawyers?
Both.
Elaborate.
Oh, you want me to elaborate? Number one, the lawyers in some of those cities do have good defense team. Unfortunately, in a large of the big cities like that, you have doctors that come from different places that have different kind of training and different kind of social backgrounds. Not social is not the correct term. Not ethnic, but where they're from. You know, what country. That country that they're from may have a different standard of social standings than we have. And it's very hard for those doctors sometimes to leave that where they came from. They bring it with them. And that's unacceptable in this country. And they don't communicate well sometimes. So I think that plays a little bit of a part in it. And you just have a lot of people sitting on juries in those cities that don't know how to evaluate a very complicated case of med mal or even class action lawsuits. They get so complicated you really need a very intelligent person to follow them. I was talking to someone last night who brought that very subject up as she was sitting on a jury. So that begs the question, are we going to go to the fact that we have a jury of the public or a jury of peers, or do we even consider going professional jurors in this country to save the legal system? I think that's where we might go eventually.
We've got one more question.
Time for one more.
Dr. You talked a lot in the past about growth for acquisition.
About what?
About growth for acquisition.
Yeah.
I guess over the last year it hasn't come to fruition. Maybe you could talk about your capital management priorities over, you know, the near term.
The question is, we have stated we're going to grow by acquisition, and we haven't. I'm going to disagree with that because we've made two acquisitions in the last 2 years, and you don't just assimilate those overnight. There's a lot of changes to make. So you want to know what we're going to do with the extra money that's in our pocket from the sale that we made and the profits we've made that seems to be really bothering the investment community, that it's just sitting there. Is that the question? I don't know. The answer is we do have excess capital. We are looking at various options right now, and we have been looking at various options for a while. I don't think there's going to be any acquisitions in the next year or two because I think we got about two more years in this cycle before a lot of these people start getting in trouble, and then there's going to be a lot of acquisitions. So I said, I'm saving the money for that. Well, then somebody tells me last night, look, give us the money. We'll lend you some money for that when you need it. At any rate, What we probably will start looking at is our various options, and you know what they are. Do we pay dividends, special dividends, regular dividends? Do we buy back stock? Those types of things. Do we retire a debt? And there again, we've got not a lot of debt, but we've got debt on the book that's $250 million. But it only consists of about 15 to 16% of our equity. And actually, we'd rather have a little bit more debt. We'd rather be a little more leveraged. So question whether or not we want to pay that off. I do want to get rid of the convertible debentures in 2008. So we're looking at that. And I must tell you that the convertible debentures are callable July of 2008. And so we're right now making plans on what we're going to do with that. And there will probably be some decisions made in the next month or two about what we're going to do with that redundant capital. So I'm not interested in any suggestions.
Great.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.